From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Jeffrey Goldberg, who has covered the Middle East for The New Yorker magazine. He first went to Israel as a young Zionist eager to join the Israeli army. In 1990, he became a military policeman at Israel's largest prison for Palestinians. Many of the prisoners were active in the Intifada. Goldberg's new memoir, Prisoners, is about working in the prison and how it changed his views on the Middle East. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the first album since 1999 by Skritti Politti, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new NBC sitcom 30 Rock, created by and starring Tina Fey, the former head writer of Saturday Night Live. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Jeffrey Goldberg was the Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker before becoming its Washington correspondent. His first experience in the Middle East was as a young Zionist from Long Island who had gone to Israel to join the military. In 1990, at the start of the Intifada, Goldberg was a military policeman in Ketziot, Israel's largest prison for Palestinians. Goldberg says Ketziot was a city of barbed wire, moldy tents, machine gun towers, armored personnel carriers, sullen Arabs, and embittered Israeli soldiers. During this time, Goldberg says, the prison held more than 6,000 Palestinians, many of whom were the Intifada's foot soldiers, squad commanders, generals, and propagandists. Goldberg's experience in the prison, which altered his views on the Middle East, is the subject of his new memoir, Prisoners, A Muslim and a Jew Across the Middle East Divide. It's partly about the friendship he formed with one of the Palestinian prisoners. Jeffrey Goldberg, welcome back to Fresh Air. The prison where you worked as a guard was nicknamed Revolutionary University. How did it get that name? Why did it get that name?
Well, it was, first of all, it was as large as a university. We had, the time I was there, roughly 6,200 prisoners. And the culture of the place was that the Israelis were in charge of security, obviously, and if you tried to escape, you would be shot. But inside the wire, if you will, the Palestinians were given a lot of autonomy, and they used that autonomy to good effect. They used it to set up classes, basically, all day long. They would run in the tents, and they would take the younger generation of Intifada activists, meaning the kids who were picked up for throwing rocks by the Israeli army, and they would take them and they would put them into this school, essentially, where they would teach them to become educated and hardened Palestinian activists. So you had a situation in which Israel was working against itself in a kind of way. In exchange for peace and quiet, the Israelis granted the Palestinians this autonomy. They used the autonomy to turn unstreetwise kids into very hardened Intifada activists.
When you describe this as a university, were there actual like classes and lectures in the prison?
They had, yeah. It was actually amazing to watch, and they didn't hide this because we acquiesced to it. They would gather in a tent and sit around in a circle, and a senior figure in the PLO or Hamas, whichever group was organizing this particular lecture, would talk for an hour, and he would take questions, and they weren't allowed to have notebooks, but they frequently did anyway, and they would take notes, and it was remarkable, actually. I mean, it wasn't, let's say, there wasn't the sort of academic freedom that we're used to in America. It was more pedantic than that. The lectures, from what I could glean, were propagandistic in nature. There were also, though, very interesting courses, if you will, on how to resist interrogation techniques and how to identify someone in your community who might be collaborating with the Israelis. So it was sort of a trade school on the one hand, a trade school for future uprising leaders, and it was also a more academic program in the sense that they were teaching Palestinian history and Israeli history from a Palestinian perspective.
When you were a guard in the Israeli prison during the first Intifada, most of the prisoners were affiliated with Hamas or Fatah. And what was the power structure like between those two groups within the prison?
Well, Fatah was entirely in charge. Hamas was a minority. They probably had 25% or 20% of the prisoners. Fatah was took charge of every sub-block, and there were frequent fights between them. Sometimes they even became physical fights over what you and I would consider mundane issues: who's the distribution of food, the distribution of work details. If you were Fatah, if you aligned yourself with Fatah when you came into the prison, you would get the best jobs. You would get to work in the kitchen, which was considered a plus because there was a hot shower. You would get to even be on the garbage detail, which sounds like no fun, but it led you out of your cage, in essence, and let you wander around the prison and pick up garbage. So Fatah was in charge, and not only that, Fatah was complicit in a kind of way with the Israeli authorities who ran the prison. In exchange for letting Fatah be in charge, the Israelis, we expected Fatah to keep a lid on things. So if another group, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, decided that they wanted to kill a guard or riot, it was up to Fatah to try to stop it before it happened.
Now, you were a guard at an Israeli prison because...
Right. Actually, because, my title, if, yeah, yes. it's my title is, it was almost comical in its translation. It was prisoner counselor, which meant that I wasn't a guard. I wasn't actually armed during the day. My job was to see, look after their health needs and look after their eating and their religious needs and trying to stop them from rioting and a whole range of things. But I was in direct close contact with them. Guards were generally people in the towers with machine guns.
This also gave you the opportunity to talk with prisoners.
Oh, all the time. They were the only people around to talk to.
Why did you want to serve in the Israeli military? Just to back up in your story, you're an American. You grew up in Long Island.
Yeah.
But you wanted to go to Israel, and you wanted to serve in the Israeli army, and that's how you got your position in the prison. It was a military position. Why Right. did you want to serve in the Israeli army?
When I was a kid, a couple of things. When I was a kid, I grew up in a mostly non-Jewish area. I had a problem for a while as a young kid with, let's call it schoolyard anti-Semitism, and I felt quite alienated from my surroundings. And in searching around for an answer to this problem that I was having, I discovered that there was a country in the Middle East with Jews who carried guns. And so that was a very attractive idea to me as a young man, as a teenager. And I fell in love with the idea of a Jewish armed force. And, you know, of course, back then, what were we thinking about when we thought about the Israeli army? We were thinking about the miraculous victory in 1967. We were thinking about the raid on Entebbe in 1976, which was also a miracle and also proof that some Jews don't take violence lying down. And so I had as a model for manly Jewish behavior, if you will, the Israeli army. So that was my initial attraction to it. And then I developed an ideological program, if you will, that took me on this course. And that was as follows. The lesson of the Holocaust to a lot of people is those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. The lesson that I developed for myself was that armed Jews are harder to kill than unarmed Jews. And therefore, I wanted to be one of these armed Jews.
Would you ever have wanted to join the American military?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, when my first year in college, I joined ROTC because I wanted to get that training. In retrospect, I wish, in some ways, in retrospect, I wish that I had joined the American Army. But at the time, I felt as if I was an Israeli, that I was born in the wrong place, that I was meant to be an Israeli, that I was meant to be in Israel. I only really discovered my Americanness, if you will, by moving 6,000 miles away to this Middle Eastern country.
What made you feel more American in Israel than you did in America?
I'll tell you a story, which will maybe explain it a little bit. When I was in the prison, we often used collective punishment against the prisoners. There was a day, I'll give you an example, there was a day in which a prisoner threw a rock and that hit a guard in the head and started bleeding. And it became a big crisis. And, you know, it's the Middle East, so even when everything is calm and cool, everybody's yelling anyway. So you can imagine what it sounds like when there's an actual crisis. And everybody's screaming and yelling. And my commander comes over to me, I was in charge of that block at the time, and says, take the guy who did it and put him in the isolation tank, you know, in solitary. And I said, I don't know who did it. There's thousands of Palestinians all over the place. I don't know who did it. And he said, it doesn't matter. Just take anyone. And I didn't even understand the order. I mean, what do you mean take anyone? And he said, just take anyone. Just grab a Palestinian and put him in isolation. And the thought that I had at that moment was, well, that's a very un-American idea. I mean, you don't punish innocent people because somebody in their group did something. You find the guilty party and you punish him. And so collective punishment struck me as, and it's really true that the term that came to my mind was un-American, and that was the beginning of a process where I saw that I was not of the Middle East in a kind of way, that I was in ideological makeup and in temperament more of a liberal American Jew.
What were some of the other things that you were called on to do while working in the Israeli prison within the military that put you in an uncomfortable position?
Well, almost everything, I think. I disagreed with the entire premise of the prison in the following sense. The first uprising that started in 1987 was an uprising against the occupation of 1967. And I disagreed with the occupation. I disagreed with the settlement policy most strongly. And I realized very early on that if I had been Palestinian, I would be behind these fences, behind this barbed wire. I was called on to do things that I didn't agree with. I never lost myself in the prison. One of the things that prisoners did, still do, and this is universal, is they try to goad you into violence. They try to goad you into hitting them or beating them or punishing them. It's a form of power. And I never hit a Palestinian. I never hit a Palestinian who wasn't already hitting me, let's put it that way. And I always tried to behave in a way that would bring credit to, I mean, this is going to sound funny, but would bring credit to Israel. I wanted the Palestinians to see that Jewish people, even in these unfortunate circumstances in which we all found ourselves, that Jewish people can behave in a humane way.
Yeah, let me paraphrase something you say in the book. You say you didn't want the prisoners to think the Jews were cruel by nature. Perhaps right. A bit of thoughtfulness, a gentle word here or there, might make the Palestinians see the humanity of the Jews. Yeah. So now there's two ways of looking at your point of view. One is that Palestinians would see the humanity of the Jews and your humanity with a kind word or, you know, a bit of thoughtfulness. But, you know, other people might argue that it just would make them think you're weak. You know, that in a power situation like that, that kindness is often misinterpreted as weakness.
Oh, I'll give you a perfect example of that. They had in the prison, they had ping pong tables, which were provided by the Red Cross. And one of the things they would do, I mean, this is a small example, but I think it's very telling. One of the things they would do is they would constantly hit the balls over the fences and make us, the soldiers, chase after their ping pong balls and then bring them back. And, you know, the first time I did this about four or five times before I realized that, wait a second, they're just playing with me. And finally, one of the guards who was with me, who had been in the prison for a while, the next time that they hit the ball over the fence, he went over and crushed the ball with his boot and said, no more ping pong. And, you know, and what it was a lesson designed for my benefit. And the lesson was, you know, if don't think that these people are saints. They are trying to goad you and work you, and they hate you. And so you can go fetch their ping pong balls all day. They're still going to hate you.
My guest is Jeffrey Goldberg, the current Washington correspondent and former Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker. His new memoir is called Prisoners. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Goldberg. He's the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, and before that he was the Middle East correspondent for the magazine. He's written a new book called Prisoners, A Muslim and a Jew Across the Middle East Divide, and it's about the period in the early 90s when he joined the Israeli military and worked in an Israeli prison housing Palestinian prisoners. When you worked in the prison, you established a kind of friendship with a prisoner, and your book revolves around this. And his name was Rafiq Hijazi. You describe one of the words you used to describe him is charming. What did you find kind of charming about this Palestinian who was your prisoner?
First of all, he was bookish and studious. I mean, literally bookish. We had, believe it or not, a library cart that would come through the prison, and he was always taking books off the library cart and swallowing them, basically, and returning them. And I Like, I was a kid who spent a lot of time in the library. I like to read. And so I found some sort of, I noticed his behavior early on. There was something else about him I noticed when we started speaking regularly, which was that he had a kind of un-Middle Eastern-like detachment from the reality that surrounded us, meaning that he also saw, like I saw, he saw the absurdity of the place. And he also, like me to some degree, was a bit of a critic of his own people. He's a loyal son of his people, as I think I'm a loyal son of my people. But he also said things to me that made me think that he believed that the Palestinians were also less than perfect. And so we had a kind of joking, funny relationship. I mean, it was a constricted relationship. He was on one side of a barbed wire coil and I was on the other. But I would go over to him sometimes and we would just chat about the various stupidities that we saw during the day.
Like what? What would you agree was stupid?
The pettiness, the terrible pettiness of the place, the behavior of some of our commanders who took Palestinians out for punishment for minor offenses on the Palestinian side. I guess it would be the sometimes ridiculous arguments between Hamas and Fatah and the PLO. He was in the PLO, Rafiq, and just laughing about the arguments that the Hamas guys would start. I mean, Hamas guys would start arguments about anything, including how much bean stew their guys were getting as opposed to the PLO guys, or who had the access to the ping pong table at what time. I mean, it's amazing how petty things can get when you have nothing else to argue about.
What was Rafiq's position within the prison power structure?
Well, I only learned this later, of course, but he was quite high in the prison power structure. He was a young guy, but he was very smart, obviously, and he was the head of the security committee, the internal security committee, which was meant to ferret out collaborators.
Did talking with him while he was in prison help you understand Palestinian positions that you hadn't understood before?
Well, I understood very little about Palestinians. I'd never met a Palestinian before this in any sort of meaningful way. I'm from Long Island. You know, we didn't have huge numbers of Palestinians on Long Island. So I think what I got to look, I had some book learning, if you will. I had read everything there is to read about the Middle East. But what I began to see was I began to understand his perspective a little bit when he spoke about how his parents had to flee the town in what's now Israel. Ashkelon is the name of the town. When they had to flee that town in 1948, as the Egyptians and the Israelis were fighting over it, and he talked about the pain that his parents felt, I actually began to understand it in a personal way. I hope that when we spoke about, let's say, the Holocaust, that he also began to absorb the idea that Jews too felt pain. I mean, this is the signal problem in the Middle East. The signal problem in the Middle East is that one tribe is completely incapable of feeling understanding the pain of another tribe, and if you can reach out beyond the boundaries of your tribe and at least recognize the humanity of the other person, that's one basis for hope.
During the first Intifada, when you were working at the Israeli prison, you thought that if the Palestinians had taken up the nonviolent civil disobedience concepts practiced by Gandhi and Martin Luther King, that they might have broken the occupation in a week. Rafiq, the Palestinian prisoner who you had a lot of conversations with, completely disagreed with you. What was his point of view on that?
Yeah, I made quite a spectacle of myself arguing for arguing the Southern Christian Leadership Conference position on nonviolence in the Israeli desert by the Egyptian border. My naivete it still stuns me sometimes. Rafiq argued that he argued a couple of things. He argued one that the Israelis are too brutal to have responded in a humane way to passive resistance. And I disagreed with that, obviously. I think the Israelis, of all peoples in the world, because it's a democracy, because it's an open democracy, I don't think Israel could have taken more than a week or two of passive nonviolent resistance of the Palestinians. There's another aspect of this. It wasn't only Rafik who said this. It's almost embarrassing to talk about how naive I was, but I would go to these Palestinian leaders of even Hamas, and say, you know, talk about Gandhi and the Salt March and Martin Luther King and the sit-ins at Woolworths, and I would explain in my incredibly naive, very American way that the moral force of sitting there and taking a beating defeated the enemies of equality. And the answer inevitably from many different Palestinians was, you expect us, Arab men, to sit there and let ourselves be beaten by Jews? The Middle East is a different place, and there are different standards of what makes a man. And there also is another phenomenon, which is that it's very, very painful for Muslims to be dominated by Jews, and by Jews in particular, because unlike Christians, Muslims and Christians have been fighting and warring for 1,400 years. But Jews have always been docile and subordinate to Muslims until the rise of modern Zionism. And it's very, very hard. This is something I learned in the prison. It's very, very hard for Palestinian men to reconcile themselves to the fact that Jews are in charge of their lives. It was a very painful thing for them.
Jeffrey Goldberg's new memoir is called Prisoners. He's the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Universal Pictures, presenting Robin Williams in Man of the Year, from Barry Levinson, director of Good Morning Vietnam and Rain Man, in theaters Friday, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Jeffrey Goldberg. Ken Tucker reviews Skritti Politti's first album since 1999, and David Bianculli reviews the new NBC sitcom 30 Rock, starring Tina Fey, Tracy Morgan, and Alec Baldwin. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeffrey Goldberg, the former Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker and its current Washington correspondent. His new memoir, Prisoners, is about his experiences in the early 90s when, as a young Zionist, he'd left the U.S. for Israel and joined the military. In the early part of the First Intifada, he was a military policeman at an Israeli prison that held thousands of Palestinians, many of whom were active in the Intifada. How did you decide to leave Israel and the Israeli military?
I have a weakness for oversimplified idealism. And so when I was growing up, I thought of Israel as a utopia. And I mean, it was to the point where the first time I saw somebody litter in Israel, I was shocked. I couldn't believe that anybody would throw garbage on such holy ground. And you know, here's the thing: no country can match that hope that I had. I mean, Israel is not a utopia; it's a real place with real people and real problems. But when I got out of the prison, I thought to myself, well, this is not the country that I imagined, and this is not where I want to be. Like I said, I know in a way I discovered my Americanness when I was there. I felt suddenly like Thomas Jefferson in the prison. I always felt when I was growing up in America like David Ben-Gurion. I had to go to Israel to feel like Jefferson. So I decided that I couldn't live there because it didn't meet my expectations, which was unfortunate because nothing could meet those expectations. So I decided to try life in America again. I was helped by a couple of things. One was ambition in journalism. I could not have functioned in Israel as an English language journalist and achieved what I wanted to achieve. The other was that I met a woman who became my wife, who did not want to live in Israel, who had spent a year in Israel and thought that that was quite nice and quite enough. And so I had a lot of reasons to leave.
You know, listening to you talk, I can't help but wonder if you'd worked at a prison in America, whether you would have felt you had to leave America.
I can't imagine a scenario in which I would have worked in a prison in America, I have to tell you that. But, right. It's a very interesting point you make. I transferred all this idealism to America. When I left Israel, I transferred this sense of idealism to America, both as a Jew and as an American. As a Jew, I thought to myself, well, America might actually be the promised land. I mean, look at this country. Jews can do anything in this country, and there's really no anti-Semitism to speak of. And then I became newly enamored of the American ideal and the American dream and the American idea. It's not as neat as this, but then Abu Ghraib happened, and I thought to myself, wow, that would never have happened in an Israeli prison. I always thought that the Israeli prisons were cruel and mean places, but then I saw what happened in that prison in Iraq, and I thought to myself, we would never have done that. And we, I meant Israel. So I become, as I said, I have this tendency toward oversimplified idealism.
We were talking before about the prisoner in the Israeli prison who you kind of befriended, Rafik. What's he doing now?
Rafik now is a professor of statistics in the United Arab Emirates, and he is not living in Gaza. And I think that's interesting because I'm always thinking about why did we become friends, or why did we become friendly? And one of the things that we shared, I think, was disappointment in our own peoples, and this is a limited kind of disappointment. I love Israel; it's the Jewish homeland, and I believe that it's a moral necessity. But I can't help but being disappointed at some of the things Israel does. I think with Rafik, it's sort of the same thing. He wants to be a top academic and a top professor of statistics. God knows why, but that's what his interest is, statistics. And he felt very strongly that he could not achieve the academic success that he wanted to achieve in Gaza, in the universities in Gaza, and therefore he's not in Gaza. And we're both, in a way, self-exiled from our dreamlands, if you will.
You know, he got a scholarship to American University in right. Washington, D.C., and you wondered how he could be educated in the West and yet dislike it so much. And he says to you, do you think they educated me out of goodness? They have a goal. They want to change the world according to the way they want. And by that he meant, you say, a world receptive to consumerism and secularism.
Right.
I thought that was interesting that he would accept the scholarship to American University and at the same time feel used and manipulated by it.
Rafik had a difficult time in America for any number of reasons. It was a combination of political and cultural. You know how there's this debate, do they hate us because of what we do or who we are? And I always think that's a self-limiting debate. It could be both. And I think with Rafik, he came to dislike America for a couple of reasons. One was a culture of rampant consumerism and a culture that treated women's bodies as objects of lust and desire. He also didn't like the politics. He didn't like the fact that that America was supporting Israel in its fight against the Palestinians. He didn't like the fact that, in his view, and I found this very interesting, in his view, America was taking the Shiite side in Iraq over the Sunnis, because he's a Palestinian and all Palestinians are Sunni, Sunni Muslims. So he did feel resentment toward the scholarship, and this is where we had a breakdown in our relationship, because I thought this was a suggestion of I thought he was being ungracious toward his hosts in a sense, and we argued about this, and I said, you've gotten this scholarship because you're a good student, and they want to train you, and they want you to go out into the world and do good things. And his belief was that American universities and America itself brings Muslims to America in order to make them into Americans. And to Rafiq, being American is not a good thing. It's all those things that you talk about, secular and consumerist and materialistic. And America, in a way, to him, is a place that draws Muslims away from God. And he was very upset by what he saw in America.
My guest is Jeffrey Goldberg, the current Washington correspondent and former Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker. His new memoir is called Prisoners. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Goldberg, and he's the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine, and he's the magazine's former Middle East correspondent. His new book, Prisoners, A Muslim and a Jew Across the Middle East Divide, is a memoir focusing on the early 90s when he moved to Israel, joined the Israeli army, and worked in an Israeli prison housing Palestinian prisoners. Your latest trip to Gaza was in August of this year, and this was during the Israeli war with Lebanon, and you met with several people there. There's a few really fascinating things in the New Yorker article you wrote based on this trip. One of the people you met with was a leader of the Qassam Brigades in Gaza, Abu Hussein. First of all, just tell us briefly what the Qassam Brigades are.
The Qassam Brigade is the self-described military wing of Hamas. They're the ones who do the rocket launching and the suicide bombing.
So Abu Hussein has a son who was in ninth grade when you were visiting, and the father said about him, "I want him to finish his studies, but if he happens to die, I don't have a problem, so long as he dies as a martyr, and on the condition that he takes Jews with him when he dies. I will be happy if he dies this way." First of all, I want to say that your being Jewish and his knowledge of the fact that you were Jewish obviously wasn't inhibiting him from...
No. I think he was fairly blunt about his desires.
Uh-huh. And then his son was there. And what did his son do after his father said this?
His son did a couple of things that I found very distressing. I mean, I'm a father, so of course I found this distressing. One was he got for me his martyr photo. A lot of the boys in Gaza have a picture taken of them with AK-47s or other weaponry and dressed in military clothing. And they actually refer to it as their martyr picture. And this is to be used when they die as martyrs. It's to be put on posters and in newspapers, and it's to show how they looked and as valiant fighters. And I found it just so distressing that they would have this picture taken in advance of their own deaths, even if their deaths weren't planned. They just wanted to have it the way people in America would have their resumes handy in case a job opportunity arose. They would have their martyr photo handy in case they died fighting Israel. And then the second thing he did was say, after his father had made a kind of speech about how he would like his kid to finish his studies, but, you know, if he dies blowing himself up, well, that's also okay. He looked at me, the kid looked at me and said, laughing. He said this laughing. He said, "And I'm his only son." And the perversity of that moment has stayed with me. It's a very depressing idea. And so I was very depressed by that moment.
Now, you also met with Rafiq Hamduna, a former Fatah leader who heads an organization of Palestinians who have served time in Israeli jails.
Yeah.
And I want to compare what he said about his son, and I'll read the quote. He said, "My son Basil came to me one day and said he wanted to be a martyr bomber. I had to keep calm. I said to him, 'Basil, do you know what happens when you blow yourself up? You don't go to heaven. You go into a hole in the ground and you get covered up with dirt.'"
This, by the way, is the reason that I'm not without hope. I think I'm the only person who left Gaza this summer more optimistic than when I went in. And it's one of the reasons why I'm not a total pessimist. And the book is not ultimately a pessimistic book. It's because there is this war going on inside Palestinian society and inside Muslim society at large. It's a war between, not to be too melodramatic about it, but between the forces of death and the forces of life. And, you know, we talk about this clash of civilizations. This is where the clash of civilizations is taking place, inside Muslim society. And I met a lot of people like Rafiq Hamduna, the one who is telling his kid, don't become a martyr bomber. Make your life good on this earth. Don't think about heaven. Let's think about what we can do here to make life better. I met a lot of people like that. A lot of them, by the way, and this is, in a way, a point of my book as well. A lot of those people were people who had spent 10 or 15 years in Israeli prisons and now wanted for their sons what they didn't have, which is to say, innocent youth and an uninterrupted education and calm and quiet and peace. And so each place I went this summer, I met both these kinds of fathers, let's say. The father who would be happy to see his son sacrifice his life in order to get revenge against the Jews. And then the father who wants to make a compromise with the Jews so that his son might live. And that's why I'm not without hope.
How do you think the recent war between Israel and Hezbollah is going to affect the future of Middle East peace or war?
I think the problem of this past summer's war is that neither party won. Hezbollah recognizes that it did not win this war. Israel certainly recognizes that it did not win this war. And what I'm afraid of is that there's going to be, as we used to say as kids, a do-over war sometime in the future. I think, look, I have hopes and then I have analysis. My hope is that this taught Hezbollah that it could not, in fact, destroy Israel. One of the differences between Hezbollah and Hamas is that while both parties, both groups, say that they want to destroy Israel, only Hezbollah, it seemed to me, believed that it was actually possible. I don't think that Hamas actually believes that to be possible. And I'm hoping that the lesson Hezbollah took away from this episode is that it might not be possible to physically destroy Israel. Israel's not as weak a state as Hezbollah ideology would have it be. And so that would be a positive. But I am afraid that there's going to be a second war to settle this, because the energy in Hezbollah is a jihadist energy, and the desire to hurt Israel sometimes trumps the desire for self-preservation.
You described yourself when you went to Israel as having been a dewy-eyed ideologue. Does the fact that you are neither dewy-eyed nor an ideologue anymore also leave you with some hope that other people who are ideologues might at some point stop being ideologues?
Yes, that's the message of my book, I think, which is that there are people on both sides of this conflict who will accept an imperfect peace. And that's the key thing here, is to recognize that not all dreams can be fulfilled. And the Israeli dreams can't all be fulfilled, and the Palestinian dreams can't all be fulfilled. If we have enough people on both sides who recognize that, then we have a chance for peace.
Jeffrey Goldberg, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg's new memoir is called Prisoners. He's the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Scritti Politti's new CD, its first since 1999. When the band got started in the late 70s, it made loud, clanging political music. The new CD is a solo effort by founding member Green Gartside, a 51-year-old Welshman.
I held conviction in the palm of my hand, the day at the start of June. You could see it breathing, and I could feed it blood from a spoon.
Green Gartside recorded every second of White Bread, Black Beer in the bedroom of his house in the Hackney Borough of London. He calls it a Skritti Politti album, but that group, founded in the rubble of punk rock, no longer exists as such. What remains is Gartside, multi-tracking his voice, making the sounds of guitars and keyboards and drums. He sings in a soft voice about endless romance, into which reality occasionally intrudes.
I was getting me down. Took a train into town, and the sun was shining brightly, though the snow was falling lightly too. Made me think of how brave you are, and how come I have strayed so far, and why everything came apart. In my head and heart alone, you will never be without me. You will never need to doubt me. There'll be something good about me soon. Like sun in the city snow, like snow in the city sun.
That's Green Gartside pledging his love on the achingly beautiful Snow in Sun. Like a lot of his songs, it includes a few unexpected details. On that one, in the midst of making hymns to the way snow glistens in the sun, he inserts the blithe couplet, "Looks like maybe we'll lose our home, out of pocket and all alone." At first, you're brought up short by this observation. Its effect is to make you listen more carefully. There's a lot going on in this deceptively simple music. Small dramas are played out. Love is tested. Temptations loom. On a long song called Dr. Abernathy, the title character seems sinister. There are lines about methamphetamine and how he's, quote, looking for volunteers. But ultimately, the jauntiness of the music triumphs over the potential gloom.
Dr. Abernathy called to see if you were here. He wanted heroin. You were in. He wanted mescaline. I gave him gin. Dr. Abernathy, the Olive Boulevard.
So long,
I finished it on Saturday. I started.
If Gartside's music sounds familiar, you may be remembering one of Skritti Politti's American hits from the 80s, like The Sweetest Girl or The Perfect Way. The latter a song so irresistible, Miles Davis did a cover version of it. For a guy who founded a chapter of the Young Communist League as a teenager and still talks Marxist theory in interviews, Gartside is certainly in touch with his pop feelings, sometimes sounding like a more reflective Michael Jackson.
Monkey and a woman in a negligee, rocking in the kitchen till the break of the day. Monkey and a woman in a uniform, rocking in the kitchen till the break of the dawn. You're my baby girl, you're my baby girl, you're my baby girl. I love a machine. Gonna rock you, honey, ready and not gonna steal your money. Gonna rock you, honey, ready and not gonna steal your money.
I think what I like most about Green Gartside is that, for all of his self-consciousness about what it means to be a pop star, at least in his homeland, he's not ironic in the music he makes. He's shrewd, he's knowing, but he's not cynical about the pleasures of pretty melodies and lyrics about how being in love can make you a smarter, wiser person. He's a romantic, but he knows that romanticism is a rich, complex form, one that he tries to present in the most straightforward manner possible.
Ken Tucker reviewed the new Squiddy Politti CD, White Bread, Black Beer. Although the CD is a solo effort by Green Guardside, he assembled a new band for live performances. After several concerts in the UK, the band starts an American tour at the end of this month. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the new sitcom 30 Rock, created by and starring Tina Fey, former Weekend Update anchor and head writer on Saturday Night Live. This is Fresh Air. Last month, NBC presented Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, a new comedy-drama series created by Aaron Sorkin, offering a behind-the-scenes look at a fictional late-night live variety show. Tonight, NBC presents another new series with the exact same premise. It's called 30 Rock, it's a 30-minute sitcom, and its creator and star is Tina Fey, former head writer and Weekend Update anchor on Saturday Night Live. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, already has raved about Studio 60. Now he wants to rave about 30 Rock.
This summer, when TV critics asked NBC executive Kevin Reilly why in the world he was scheduling two different shows with the same basic live TV concept, he had a good answer. Both shows came in at the same time, both were by very gifted writers, and both pilot episodes showed too much promise to ignore. He's right on all counts. But that doesn't make it any easier on viewers, who already have been watching or not watching Sorkin's Studio 60 for 4 weeks, and now have to differentiate between the two shows. Fortunately for NBC, Tina Fey is not only writing and starring in 30 Rock, which premieres tonight, she's writing the network promos for her new sitcom, too, and they're as flip and funny as the show itself. Here's one that aired, very deliberately, midway through last week's Studio 60, featuring Faye and her 30 Rock co-star, Alec Baldwin.
Alec, thank you so much for agreeing to star in my new show, 30 Rock.
Yeah, right. So when do I get to meet Aaron?
Excuse me?
Aaron Sorkin, the West Wing guy. When do I get to meet him?
Oh, no, that's not this show. That's the other NBC show about late-night TV.
This is the one with Amanda Peet, right?
No, this is me and you and Tracy Morgan.
Oh, no. No.
The title 30 Rock refers to the address at New York's Rockefeller Plaza, from which Saturday Night Live is broadcast live. Where Sorkin's fictional Studio 60 show emanates from Hollywood, broadcast by the equally fictional NBS network, Tina Fey sets her show in the real world, one she knows well. It's live from New York and supposedly is presented by NBC. She plays Liz Lemon, head writer of The Girly Show, a sketch comedy series starring Jenna Maroney, played by Jane Krakowski, who provides a perfectly delightful mix of talent, vanity, and insecurity. Tracy Jordan, a loose cannon movie star played by Tracy Morgan, enters the mix when he's hired by a new NBC executive, Jack Donaghy, to inject The Girly Show with what he calls a third kind of heat. It's something he knows a lot about due to his previous executive experience. Donaghy is played by Alec Baldwin. And, as in the promo, he's the super-secret weapon of 30 Rock. Faye, Morgan, and Alec Baldwin all hail from Saturday Night Live. Faye is head writer, Morgan is sketch player, Baldwin as a fearlessly funny and understandably frequent guest host. Like Steve Martin in the old days, and Christopher Walken in the newer ones, Alec Baldwin is the type of SNL guest host who comes in and not only steals the show, but raises it to a higher level. Baldwin does it with 30 Rock just as effortlessly. Here he is in the scene where newly hired executive Donaghy has his first meeting with Liz, played by Tina Fey, and her producer Pete, played by Scott Adsit. He's explaining how he got his job.
The GE Trivection oven cooks perfect food 5 times faster than a conventional oven because it uses 3 kinds of heat. Thermal technology for consistent temperature, GE Precise Air Convection technology for optimal air circulation, and microwave technology for incredible speed. With 3 kinds of heat, you can cook a turkey in 22 minutes.
Wow, that is impressive.
The people upstairs think so. That's why they promoted me. That's why they sent me here to retool your show.
Retool what now?
I'm the new vice president of East Coast Television and Microwave Oven Programming.
That sounds like you program microwave ovens.
I like you. You have the boldness of a much younger woman.
One really amusing thing about that scene is how dead on it is. How so many network executives these days come from marketing or technology, yet feel totally equipped to make creative decisions about dramas and comedies. One really amazing thing about that scene is that there really is such an appliance as a GE Trivection oven. 30 Rock comes to TV tonight as NBC's most polished new comedy series since My Name is Earl. And like Earl, 30 Rock belongs on Thursdays. For now, 30 Rock is in a much more competitive time slot, leading off Wednesday nights for NBC. But find 30 Rock and watch it. Comedy is an endangered species on primetime network TV right now, so when something this good comes along, it has to be supported.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News.
Tally-ho.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of The Other Side of the Bridge, a story of sibling rivalry and misguided intentions by Mary Lawson, author of Crow Lake. From Universal Pictures, presenting Robin Williams in Man of the Year, from Barry Levinson, director of Good Morning Vietnam and Rain Man, in theaters Friday. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most, GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, playwright and filmmaker Neil LaBute. His movies like In the Company of Men and Your Friends and Neighbors explore misanthropic behavior. He began staging this kind of work when he was a Mormon at Brigham Young University. The school did not approve. LaBute has a new one-man show starring Ed Harris. Join us for the next Fresh Air.